Welcome to the Peter Moon Podcast, brought to you by Sky Books and the music of Lisa.
This talk is on the Sigil de Amoth, and so that we clarify what the Sigil de Amoth is prior to discussing it, because all paths, at least in Western occultism, lead back to this sigil, at least for the last 400 years of Western occultism, and you can argue that it goes back to the early history of what we know as God and man. I'm going to give a brief description of what the sigil is before we get into the discussion of it itself. The sigil or sigillum de Amoth, A-E-M-E-T-H, which means sigil or seal of truth or seal of the truth of God, is an occult artifact that features a pentagram in the center surrounded by heptagrams, which are seven-pointed stars, and heptagons, which are seven-sided polygons, all within a circle. This sigil also contains a complex system of cryptographs, which is based upon symbols, numbers, English letters, and Hebrew letters. One of the features of the Sigil de Amoth is that it contains the names and methods to call upon various hierarchies of angels. Although the sigil is based upon earlier and cruder versions, it was developed and refined through crystal scrying sessions of Queen Elizabeth's court astrologer, Dr. John Dee, and his partner in scrying, Edward Talbot Kelly, during the 1880s. And for those who do not know what scrying is to look into a crystal ball. And it was a crystal ball placed over this sigil so that one could see the relationship with the letters and perhaps see more than just the letters themselves. A further feature of this Sigil de Amoth is that it contains the foundation of the Enochian or angelic language, which was also developed through the scrying sessions. It is theorized that this language is what the Creator used to facilitate the creation of the universe as we know it through the angelic hierarchy. In other words, this language could be used to direct and talk to angels, and not only could God use it, but if mankind learns how to use it, he can talk to these angelic forces. This is the idea. Although there's a very sinister side to it, which will be discussed in the talk. Whether this is true or not, or whether it can be demonstrated, the Sigil de Amoth is the foundation of Western occultism, and it can also be argued that it is the underlying catalyst behind the foundation of our modern Western culture. This discussion will feature how it came onto my path and what its significance might mean for the future. So that's the intro. We'll now proceed with the discussion and how I came to encounter it. And this is on the subject of remote viewing, and I want to stress that this is a series of podcasts on remote viewing, and so that people listening understand the context of how this fits into remote viewing. Okay. At least one context is I once had the occasion to listen to a lecture of a remote viewer who's been very highly touted by the government crowd that we've spoken about. I'm not going to mention his name because he's an insufferably boring lecturer. But except for the first part of his lecture, which he acknowledged and talked about the heritage of John Dee and Edward Kelly. Of course, they're the ones who have brought us the Sigil de Amoth as we know it, and who helped create it based upon earlier templates, but the one that was used in their workings is that this particular remote viewer said that these were the original spy masters and that they used their knowledge of the occult to recruit covens and other occult types to be their spy masters. And I thought that his whole approach to the subject was a little corny. However, it was he understood the truth of what spycraft was based upon. Now, much of what this particular man would do is talk about their remote viewing targets and blah, blah, blah. These are things you can never verify.
Right.
Now, but anyway, this remote viewing is all about spying on people. That's what it's about, to protect a political entity. Only one example is a government. So it's like, you can spy on me, I can spy on you sort of thing. So this Sigil D'Amet is the ultimate construct upon which this universe is not only based, but upon which this universe is governed. Now, when you say the word government, you say ment is mental.
Right.
Gov is to basically to rule. It's to rule the mind. Now, so this is the ultimate government. Talk about secret government. But this is also different than just political government, because political governments mimic this idea. We're talking about the politics of deity. Now, before we go any further into this subject, I want to, because we've dedicated all of these podcasts to being organic in nature.
Yes.
You had asked me a question about the apocalypse, and I think it was in podcast number 2, as regards the seventh seal. And I responded quite lengthily, and much of that response is aligned with the book I've recently passed on to you, a book that I wrote, Synchronicity and the Seventh Seal.
Which I started reading.
Right. This was printed in 2004, so it's 11 years old at this writing. First printed in 2004. Now, so that we understand the context of where we're going with this, I am currently doing a reprint of the book. And in order to reprint the book, I have to change some of the typesetting, change the cover a little bit. I mean, these are adjustments. They're not profound changes. The entire book was proofread by myself, and some very, very minor changes were done.
Okay.
But part of this, as I'm reading this part on the Sigil D'Amet, which means the sigil of truth, and a sigil being a symbol. And a sigil generally refers to symbols of an occult nature that have certain powers assigned to them, real or imagined. Now, this book, Synchronicity and the Seventh Seal, was an accumulation. Of course, now I talk about the sigil in this book. We're going to go beyond what's in the book today, or certainly reprise it and add some more context. But this book was based upon a series of experiences I had in dealing with what you might say magical folk and magical players, magicians. And these included, this is all of my work up to the first, at least the first 10 years of my writing career, I was involved with writing about magical people such as, Preston Nichols and Duncan Cameron,
right,
to name a couple, but L. Ron Hubbard, Jack Parsons, Marjorie Cameron, of course, studied the works of Aleister Crowley, so one's dealing with a residue of that, not dealing with the live magician on the spirit level. which I never really claimed to do. And his son, his bastard son, Amato Crowley, which was a pseudonym. He had another name. And I had a correspondence with him, a very lively correspondence with him, which is the subject of books I've written in the past. Montauk Revisited, Adventures in Synchronicity, primarily. But I had all of these magical tentacles wrapped around me and my psyche and all this sort of thing. So I wrote this book to literally not only transmit what I said, but I did it in such a way as to exorcise these influences from my psyche. Because it was just in the course of doing business as a writer and as an investigator. So there's a lot of occultism in this book, which is very carefully designed. The cover is carefully designed. And I'm going to read the back cover of this book.
Okay.
And it's not per se to promote the book. In fact, anybody listening to this podcast wants to read the book, maybe intrigued to read the book by what's on the back cover. But it also applies to this talk we're going to give, because this, what's on the back cover, is a warning to people. If you don't belong listening to this, then don't listen to it, because it's not meant for everybody. And this book, which sold very well out of the gate, it was only meant to be for people who could learn from it or appreciate it. So right. Here is the back cover of the book. Beware to ye who enter the ruins of Suleiman the King. For beneath the ground of where his mighty temple once stood lies the complex of caverns and hidden chambers which house his greatest mystery, a sealed bottle of brass, guarded by the denizens of the deep, a legion of daemon who will thwart anyone attempting to unseal the bottle in order to penetrate its secret power. Heed the warning for your own sake, for if you do not fear the daemon and should be so lucky as to pass them and undo the seal, and it is only luck that will enable such, you will be brought before the inside of the bottle of brass itself to confront the mirror of your own reality, which includes not only your wildest dreams and their fulfillment, but also your greatest nightmares. For a third and final time, heed the warning once again, for the path is littered with the skulls and bones of those who have failed to penetrate the mystery, yet adorn themselves with the insignia of their own failure. And this is you read the back to that, and I think you asked me about it.
Do you have any comments, Sean? It intrigued me even more, and you didn't stop there. At the beginning of the book, you even warned people again. I thought that was great.
You open up the front cover, and traditionally the back of a book is designed to tell somebody what the book's about.
Sure.
And, you know, this is a great mystery about ghost hunters who got more than they bargained for, and, you know, and you might mention some famous incident to get people intrigued. And then you open the front cover flap, and it is the same thing, only it's a different wording of what to expect in the book to entice you to read the book.
Right.
Despite warnings, you have dared to enter the realm of the Daemon Legion, who have cast misfortune upon mankind and orchestrated his suffering since the fall from grace. Beware, for this is the Legion that cast out the Messiah of Egypt, taunted the Savior of the Christians, and corrupted the religion of the Prophet of Islam. The Legion tears at the soul of humanity without mercy or conscience. Once you have entered their domain, there is no way of escape. There is but a single key couched in a magic word which offers a ray of hope. Only this word can reach the daemon, quell its restless heart, and subdue the rage it has inflicted upon humanity. Only this will exorcise the tormentors from the tormented. Learn well this magic word, and study all of its implications. For full comprehension of it, uncorks a seal within each seeker that unfurls an everlasting light and compassion that can reach all creatures and spirits. Only this word can tame the beast and make him purr. But more importantly to you, it is the only way of surviving the ordeal within the bottle of brass. It is still not too late to turn back, but if you do, knowing what you now know, you will be relegated to a life of chaos and the accompanying madness which ensues. Tread lightly, man, for this is a perilous journey and the most important one you will ever make. Study the word. For those who turn their back, I commend you to your future nightmares. For this was a spell cast long ago, and it cannot be undone. Master of the Green Djinn of Sabia, translated from the tablets of Kor.
Still haven't gotten to the part that tells me what that word is yet.
Well, you haven't gotten to the part of the word, and we will save you the mysterious intrigue, okay, since this is an organic conversation. But I mean, we will address that in just a minute. But what's important here is these are very ominous warnings, because what I had to deal with and what is encapsulated in this book, what I wrote about, it's not so really frightening for the person to read it. It'll either, I don't know what it'll do to the person that reads it, except enlighten him, possibly scare him if they're scared of their own shadow. But it certainly informed them. And it's a very different book. It's a very unique book. But the important part is that there is a solution. Studying a magic word and all of its implications, for full comprehension of it uncorks a seal within each seeker that unfurls an everlasting light and compassion that can reach all creatures and spirits. Now, we will get to this eventually, but some of the creatures and spirits I met, and I don't mean just spirits, I mean real life people, as a result of writing this book and where it went out to into the world, was quite enlightening, very enlightening, and very enriching.
Can you give an example?
No, because okay, it gets too long.
Okay.
It gets too involved. I mean, eventually we'll get to this. But to deal with the first question that you had is, what the hell's the word?
Yeah.
Well, the word. Maybe I should hold that word out, even for you who are hosting me here, as a carrot. As
okay,
a carrot. Because I'm going to explain to you the context of how I found out the word. Now, this word is the secret word of the Freemasons, the most secret word of the Freemasons. And the Freemasons, if you go to a standard Freemason book, they'll say it's Mahavane, which is their secret word is what? The builder. That means Mahavane is a Hebrew word for what? The builder. You know, who's the builder of the universe? Who's the builder of the temple?
Right.
And the temple of Solomon, which this book refers to, is a metaphor for the house of God, the house of the deity. Deity is a much more practical word to use in this respect. But they have a word, but they also have a secret word, because you can be a high-level, and I've spoken to high-level Masons who don't know this word. I've spoken to Masons, they may be high-level, who do know this word.
Yes.
And this particular man who did know the word was into some pretty interesting stuff. A very unusual man, and very well-placed in society, incredibly well-placed. In fact, I told him he used to work at Yale, and he used to get big money for going to Yale every once in a while, and I told him about the Skull and Bone Society, and he says, oh, it's so creepy. I'm never going back there again after hearing what you said. You know, he's going to give up his big, high-paying gig. You know, and it's like, you said it was so creepy. I was just telling him the standard stuff about Skull and Bones. I mean, just standard, but he is very sensitive. Anyway, all right. Now, what this book includes is sort of how I kind of come to a full understanding of this word. I'd read it before in Aleister Crowley's work, but he certainly didn't emphasize it or highlight it enough. And we're going to begin here, and how, so that we can have an appreciation of this sigil deamet, the sigil of truth, which again, is, I will repeat, is a metaphor for the construct of our reality, what holds our reality in place. And I also want to add that as I began to open the page and look at this sigil, which is in the book, just a very simple black and white illustration, is I get the email from David Anderson saying he will do a podcast with us. Right. And because David Anderson deals with the construct of time and the deconstructing of time, presumably, so does this sigil represent the construct of existence. Therefore, it either represents the construct of time or is intrinsically involved with the construct of time. Because it is this sigil, which we're speaking of, that is the foundation of what we know as the Enochian language, also called the language of the angels, which is what magicians, occult magicians, try to pursue. And this, for people who are not familiar with this, this is very serious business. I'm not just talking up a tree here. And my avocation has never been to learn the Enochian language,
right,
but it's been territory that I've been assigned to cover by the very precepts of my existence, what I'm here to do. So anyway, I'm going to, because we're talking about the Temple of Solomon, the Temple of Solomon was, according to legend, possibly history, destroyed. There were two temples, the first temple and the second temple. The second temple wasn't anywhere close to what the first temple was in terms of its magical representation. And the second temple, which is the one where Christ whipped the moneylenders, and which was already, as they say, a mockery of the first temple. It didn't even, the Holy of Holies didn't contain the Ark of the Covenant, and it was just not the same edifice. However, we go back to, this is the genesis of the Knights Templar, who took their namesake after the Temple of Solomon, where, according to history, there were artifacts beneath that temple, and this was the home ground of a cult that are known in popular terminology as the Assassins. Asen Saba was the leader of the Assassins, and he is the one, or his people, with a Moorish influence, who taught the Moors. I mean, they didn't teach the Moors. They taught the Templars the certain secrets.
Peter, can you put a year frame, a frame of reference?
Yeah, so it's the Middle Ages. It's okay. It's around 1000. Well, the Templars arise, I think, around 1100 thereabouts.
Okay.
And well, Jacques de Molay is burned in the early 1300s, but this cult arises in the Middle Ages, and the Assassins are from an Islamic sect known as the Ishmaelis, and the Ishmaelis descend from Fatima or Fatima, the daughter of Muhammad, the prophet. So, and they were, Muhammad's family was always sort of aced out of the caliphate being that which rules Islam, and like the Pope, so to speak.
Right.
But they were a sect that had had a great deal of power, and for a time period, they were headquartered in Cairo. So they filtered all the ancient Egyptian information and integrated it, for better or for worse, into their dogma and what they taught and believed. Now, Asin Saba had studied initially in the country we now know today as Morocco, in the capital city of that time, which was Fez, and that was the center of great learning. And there were the great cities of Morocco were Fez and Marrakesh. Casablanca was a port city, and Tangier was a port city with a which is right across the Straits of Gibraltar, from the Rock of Gibraltar. If you're in Tangier, you can see the Rock of Gibraltar, unless it's a very foggy day. It's not far away at all. And more, he studied with the Moors, and this is where his knowledge, he got a certain amount of knowledge there. He later went on to have a cult, which was cited by Marco Polo. This is where it got a lot of its airplay, where he could command somebody to jump off a cliff, and they would command, and they would jump. And he did this allegedly. There's a story of this just to show how powerful he was to a visiting dignitary, to show the power of these people. And he had a cult that would go in and kill, send a secret agent into a very, very important, you know, king or something, and get into his trust and then kill the king. Or threaten to kill him and make a deal. So he was very powerful.
Right.
And he lived eventually in Mount Alamut, which is in today's Iran. And that's a whole separate history, and we're not going to go into that history, except this is part of the legacy of the Temple of Solomon. And the legacy not only of the secret word, but all of the secrets associated with the secret word. Now, there is the man who was known as the father of the Beat generation, William Burroughs. Have you ever heard of him?
I've heard the name, yes.
Okay, William Burroughs was a character, an icon. He became an icon.
Right.
You know, basically, he did not have a very stellar life in any way, shape, or form. He was a junkie. He killed his wife when he was under the influence of drugs, like trying to be William Tell, and he shot her and killed her, you know, putting an apple on her head.
Yeah.
And he was, he got some good legal advice, and he got out of it. I mean, he apparently didn't mean to kill her. I don't, you know, he was just under the influence.
Right.
He was close friends with Allen Ginsberg.
Okay. I know that name.
Yeah, Allen Ginsberg was, you know, one of those early Beats. He was close friends with Jack Kerouac and Neil Cassidy. And they were four of the pivotal characters in the Beat generation, or the fathers of the Beat generation. And William Burroughs was the oldest one, so he was sort of a fatherly figure to them.
Okay.
Now, all of those people were gay, homosexual. They all had relationships with women to some degree or another. But they had a very, what you call, homosexual component inside of them. And this is one of the things that attracted William Burroughs to the country of Morocco, and in specifically the port city of Tangier, which has a reputation as an international city that goes back for centuries. Now, one of the reasons he liked, well, because he could get young prey there. You know, pedophilia is not looked upon in that country the same way as it is in our country. where it's severely frowned upon in our country.
Yeah.
Legally.
It should be.
Well, I would agree with you. But the other rest of the world isn't necessarily on the same page with the morals of the United States. And it may well be illegal to do that in Morocco, but you have a different type of culture. And we're going back here into the 50s and 60s when I'm speaking of this. So, you know, I don't know that they still treat it that same way today. I'm going back into history. But one thing is, the first peace treaty the United States had with any country was with Morocco. And they had something, and this was, I've talked about it in another one of these podcasts, but one of the features they had in that peace treaty is reciprocity. In other words, if a Moroccan is arrested in America, he can declare himself a Moorish national and be free. Like, this is the slaves. This is how the slaves could be freed. But as I told you, George Washington didn't let that be known. He acknowledged it in law, but he didn't let it known. So all of these slaves that he held and that Thomas Jefferson held, if they would have told them the truth, they could have just said, well, I'm going to declare that I'm a Moorish national and be freed, whether they were a Moorish national or not. Because the Moorish nation was much bigger than they would have acknowledged, and it included all of North America and all the way down to Mexico, at least in principle. So, in any case, we have William Burroughs going there because if he gets caught in a pedophile situation, not only was there an abundance of young men, he also would not get in trouble, because what they would do, all you would have to do is go to the American consulate and, you know, you get your wrist slaps and you'd be freed. Now, I don't know that he was ever caught, but it was a great feature of pedophiles to go to Morocco. Now, I don't mean to stress William Burroughs' passion for young boys. This is not really the purpose of where we're going here. Right. But I'm mentioning how the hell he ended up in Morocco and Tangier. There, he became acquainted with a artist, a surrealistic artist by the name of Brian Gysin. That's G-Y-S-I-N. B-R-I-O-N. And he had a restaurant called 1001 Nights in Tangier.
Right.
Now, this is an important history here. Now, Gysin and Burroughs had a common interest, and that was Hassan Sabah and the cults of the Hashishins, or assassins. They said that the word assassin came out of Hashishin because they would give them hash to program people to commit murder. And, you know, without making a judgment there, you know, William Burroughs was under the influence of something when he shot his wife. So he sort of was like an assassin by default.
Right.
He resonated with this stuff. And Hassan Sabah taught a principle. And this is the principle that he taught, which is a very interesting principle, because I've described it as a quantum maxim. It's the maxim is nothing is true. Everything is permitted. There are other iterations of that phrase, but all is permitted. Everything is permitted. So whatever goes on in this universe that you don't like, it's already been licensed. Now, that not only means the licensing of the bad act, but the retaliation to the bad act, and also the bad act not being punished. So everything has been sanctioned by deity, otherwise it wouldn't have occurred. And this told them that all quantum possibilities were possible. They were both very deep thinkers, regardless of their personal misgivings. And in the, and I don't know much about Geisen's private life, but in the case of Burroughs, he's greatly admired. But when they talk about his admiration, when people admire him, they don't always talk about his faults. And I mention them right up front here. Now,
I'm sorry. Now, when you say deity,
deity is God.
Yes, I understand. But that seems to be a different God for a bunch of different people.
Well, yes, and I say deity because deity is a non-prejudiced reference to, that could include Allah, it could include the Christian God, can, you know, sometimes described as Jehovah, sometimes described as Yahweh, and by an assortment of different names, the Trinity, the goddess, whatever you want to say. But deity is fundamentally a description of Dios. And I want to point out that Dios is imitative of the numeral 10, which is a 1 and a 0.
Right.
And a 1 and a 0 is what you know in computer talk is a binary digit.
Yes.
And that is the whole fundamental of life is duality, 0 and 1, or yin and yang. So I prefer to use the word deity because it does not lean for or against any particular religion or denomination of such religion. It's just an abstract concept for the creative principle of the universe.
It's now, just amazing to me how everything just seems to tie together.
Well, there's more here, and it all... And I'm going to approach the word because Brian Geisen was passionate about the word. Not necessarily the same word, but you'll see in a minute here. Geisen was a student, because he was a surrealistic artist, he was a student of the artistic movement known as Dada, D-A-D-A, which was post-World War I. And he had studied a poet who was referred to as the Dada poet. His name was Tristan Tzara. Tristan is Tristan, T-R-I-S-T-A-N, just like it sounds. Zara is T-Z-A-R-A. This poet had caused a riot by pulling out words from a hat and composing a poem, spontaneous. And this gave rise to a artistic movement known as Dada, which was the precursor of surrealism. And one of the most famous surrealistic paintings was Salvador Dali's clock.
Yes.
That clock. And there's a whole big thread to him we won't go into. But okay. But that surrealism is taking one element from one environment and juxtaposing with it in another environment, and in an environment that does not particularly fit. So you could have, character that, well, the Wookiee character from Star Wars, and you could put him in a, on a beach. He's going to be pretty, on a beach in the Caribbean with pirates or something.
Yeah.
It's, and then throw in some opera singers and throw in some kabuki dancers, and you have just a surrealistic situation.
Right.
Now, we're talking about somebody creating a revolution by pulling words out of a hat. And what he was doing was re-scrambling creation. And people were making statements about society with different icons. Take Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, and all sorts of different things. And, Andy Warhol sort of did that. It's an artistic statement. And what they were doing, they had a frustration with the existing system. which was of no service to the common people. So they were basically reassembling society. They were reprogramming society. The artists, as part of their native rights as members of civilization, we don't like the way society's working. We're going to re-scramble it. So Geisen, from his study of this, what he believed was wrong with creation was the word. And when he says the word, we can put the word in quotes, but we're talking about the word itself, because you have all this. This is the word of civilization, and it's not working. You have all this war, economic strife, etc., etc. So his motto was rub out the word. And what he meant by rubbing out the word is he was trying to correct the basic construct of existence by deconstructing language itself. So before we discuss the magic word, we're going to discuss something here about language. Most of our social conventions are kept in place by language and words. If you re-scramble the words, we have a new paradigm. And you do watch words change and morph, and you have new words come on the scene. The whole computer world has changed our paradigm by giving us new words. And
yes, selfie is now in the dictionary.
Exactly. Geisen taught Burroughs the importance of taking this Dada or surrealistic principle and doing it the same with words. And this became known as the cut-up method.
Thank you for listening to the Peter Moon Podcast. To purchase Peter's books, visit skybooksusa.com. Also visit Peter's blog at digitalmontauk.com. And to hear more music by Noosa, visit noosasounds.com. Welcome to the Peter Moon Podcast, brought to you by Sky Books and the music of Noosa.
The cut-up method inspired William Burroughs, believe it or not, to become involved with Scientology. He was a very famous celebrity Scientologist at one point, and this was in the 1960s. And this was after his adventures with Brian Geisen. And why he was interested in Scientology is because it dealt with the power of words. And one of the doctrines of Scientology was that if you had a moment of unconsciousness on the time track, whether it be previous lives or this life, the words that were said during that moment of pain and unconsciousness could have a reactive power over you. And he found this very significant. And what Burroughs actually said about Scientology, he says, you could accomplish in only 10 hours in Scientology what you could never accomplish in any other method, such as psychiatry. And he was just amazed at what he could accomplish with the word techniques or the auditing counseling techniques devised by Hubbard. Now, at the same time, he said that Scientology was a fascist organization, and he cut his ties with it. He did some of the upper levels.
Why did he say it was fascist?
Because it was run like a fascist operation. And during the time he said that, it was particularly fascist. I was not around then. But it was run like a dictatorship.
Okay.
By Hubbard. And then underneath him, you could have little dictators petty dictators. It ran, you know, it was not a democracy. Yeah. It was not a democracy. But in any case, I mentioned the Scientology here because Hubbard was very concerned or preoccupied with words. So when I entered Scientology in 1971, it was always stressed, and it said at the beginning of every book that he wrote, if you don't understand what you're, there's anything in this book, look up the words you didn't understand. Don't go by words you don't understand.
Which I try to do that now.
Well, it's a very intelligent thing to do, and I first encountered this idea when I was studying in high school. If I looked up the words I didn't understand, it made me much smarter.
Right.
Of course, he not only reiterated it, he brought it home and sort of metaphorically pounded you over the head with it. And this becomes a foundational cornerstone of what we're going to discuss here, this whole idea of words, because we're talking about this magic word. And if you're going to understand a magic word, you're going to understand words in general, because words are the whole. Now, I told you that words are the foundation of this restructuring of society that Geisen was interested in doing, and Burroughs. And he wrote a book based upon this called Naked Lunch. Burroughs did. And what happened with Burroughs, I said that he got interested in Scientology, but he also, when he do this cut-up method, and a cut-up method might be a bunch of words, individual words scrambled. It might be paragraphs. It might be pages.
I did it with a friend in college with guitar chords, trying to come up with new chord progressions.
Well, David Bowie uses the cut-up method for his songs, or has used it. I don't know to what extent.
Right.
And he was at one time, you know, one of the richest musicians, if not persons in the UK. Yes. At one point, might still be. I don't know. But he used it, and the foundational. This was also, as I say, a foundational element of Scientology. In other words, you understand the words you're reading, but it's also a foundation of magic. And there's a word in magic called grimoire.
Say that word again.
Grimoire. Grimoire. It's a French word. Grimoire. Okay. Grimoire. My pronunciation isn't maybe so good, but it's also means the same thing as grammar. Grammar. Grammar is basically an assemblage of letters and words. And of course, when you learn grammar, you're learning the difference of a subject and a predicate and an object and all these things and adverbs and verbs. And you're structuring language. You see, language has a structure. Some things are descriptive. Some things are denoting action. Some things are denoting somebody doing something, a protagonist, and somebody receiving something. So this is the whole idea of grammar, is the analysis of words and the association of words.
Right.
Now, this
and
is
the rules of words, right?
Yes. Now, where this becomes, I mean, and now that's common sense in our daily use. If you want to understand a newspaper, you want to have grammar so you're understanding this.
Right.
But where we're looking at this from a magical or occult perspective, and when I say occult, the hidden aspects of consciousness. Very interesting when you look up what a word actually is. And a word comes from, according to the dictionary, a pre-Indo-European word, wer, which means to speak or to say, and it says see a verb. See, wer is like verb. It's phonetically like verb. And what is a verb? Well, a verb means to speak, but it also comes from a Sanskrit word, urvata or vrata, which means command or bow. And it can also is related to another Hittite, viraga, call or summon. So when you have the word, in the beginning was the word, and the word was either God or with God, you have this idea of to speak or to say, you have an iteration, but intrinsic to the iteration is to command or to summon. Also implied the word vow there, vow, to make a vow. So there's a holy aspect or a important aspect. Now that's a word can be conveyed as an iteration that's tied to deity, as opposed to just an ordinary expression. If you say that every living creature is a part of the deity, well, then every expression in the vein of everything is permitted is an expression of the deity. But more to the point is when you're dealing with a grimoire or the grammar of a magic spell. Now, notice the word when they say magic, they say spell, because you're putting spell, you're putting letters together. You're putting words together. Now, we're going to look at the idea of logos. Logos is the divine word. Logos means word, speech, or discourse. But it's from a pre-Indo-Pian root, L-E-G, to collect. Now, collect means to speak, but it also means to pick out words. So we're talking about logos is to pick out words.
Okay.
Now, when you look at an assemblage of data, you pick out the data that you're trying to convey to somebody. So every time you speak, you're picking up words. Any expression of God, whether it be in the Bible, in a parable, or a metaphor or a tale that somebody's telling, somebody's picking out words. When the character known as Jesus speaks in the New Testament, he's picking out words to convey to people ideas. So this is one of the expressions of deity, is to pick out words. Now, logic, the word logic, which means reasoning, but it also has to do with logos, which is, again, picking out words. And the word logos relates to lecture. The word lecture, which is from a Latin lectus, meaning it's a word which means read, but originally meant to gather, pick, collect out, choose. So you're choosing words. You're choosing, you're selecting. So when we deal with the idea of grammar, we're dealing, or grimoire or spells, we're dealing with iterations. And those iterations go hand in hand with a concept. Definitely a concept. Now, I've mentioned the Scientology not only because it was an intricate part of William Burroughs' life and helped his literary career with his Naked Lunch book, which he was made into a movie and a very well-known book. But I wanted to explain some of my own experiences with these words, because had I not had these experiences, I wouldn't able to be to do what I'm doing, certainly not in the way that I'm doing it. And when I first got into Scientology, I was introduced within a short amount of time. There was a new development had come out from Hubbard called word clearing. And Scientologists were always encouraged to clear words. Well, this was a different type of word clearing whereby you would have a list of subjects read out to you while you were attached to the e-meter, which again was a biofeedback response, and it'd read back a whole list. It was a whole page of subjects, which might include chemistry, physics, foreign languages, English, geography, you name it. And when one of these would react on a meter, the counselor would ask you, is there a word in the subject that you don't understand? And more often than not, if you had a reading word, in other words, you had an emotional response to that word, there would be something in that subject you didn't understand. Yeah, I didn't understand in biology what a gametes was or a zygote. And I didn't understand, so you look up these words, and it was an earlier similar word that you didn't understand. And you go back and you clear up all of your misunderstandings that you acquired in high school, junior high school, or earlier.
So each individual person would have to do a clearing of words for themselves.
Yes, this was what your own experience. It had nothing to do with what Scientologists thought or said about various and sundry words. It was your own education.
Right.
It was designed to rehabilitate your own education and give you back what you had learned.
Okay.
Whatever you were involved with. And I remember in the middle of the session having to go take my bike to the bookstore to look up Bardo. that was the state of in between death and life for the Tibetans. I had to go look up that word because the dictionary didn't have that word.
Right.
So what you're trying to do is understand life. And this was all geared towards the idea of understanding. Now, when I got to the Apollo, the ship with Hubbard, he had just come up with a new idea. He said, well, word clearing is good, but it's not getting home to people. Now, what I want you to do before you can study Scientology is I want you to look up every word on this course, which was called the student hat, teaching you how to be a student, and look up all the words and then study the course. If you don't look up all the words. Now, this was not, this course, this procedure was extensive. Mm-hmm. And so I basically had to look up every word, not only on the course, but in the English language that was commonly used. The common vernacular we use. And then when you go to the similar words and whatnot, you're looking up all these biological words. What it does is it clears your head out of what you think. See, when you say something to a person, they might go dead. If you mention a word in physics or biology, they might just go kaplunk. They don't know what you're talking about.
Yep.
And then you also have people who could be educated, but they don't always agree on the same terms. So you can have digressions and professional physicists who might not agree on using words in the same way. And if you go into the vocabulary of physics, it gets very funny because they will use words that are used in either religion or metaphysics or philosophy, but they reinvent words. They don't want to use the same words because they'll say, well, and I think we're doing this. So they make up these convoluted words that when you say, what the hell is this? You know, instead of calling something ether, they have a different name for it.
Right.
And it's, oh my God, you know, what? Knock it off. and it's so hard to understand them sometimes unless you are predisposed towards their lingo. And this is very specialized. Now, I know the same thing's going to occur in nanotechnology, which is a whole separate science in itself, where it doesn't matter if you're a physicist, a chemist, an engineer, you're going to have to learn all the new lingo of nanotechnology because it's all different. But in any case, this idea of clearing words is very important to understanding when you come to a subject like magic, because when you start picking up the grammar or grimoire of magicians, particularly a lot of it came out during the 1600s, you go back and you see the Greater Keys of Solomon, the Lesser Keys of Solomon. This stuff is booby-trapped with words that you will not understand and you can't understand. And if you try to understand them, you're going to be put through a very complicated time, if not an excruciating time, because they're not written in such a way to be understood, and you're told if you do X, Y, and Z, A, B, C, and F will happen. It may or may not happen.
Right.
Okay, but you're walking into territory where you don't understand what the hell's going on.
Yeah. You tell so why try it?
What? Say it again?
So why try it if you're told?
Well, that's a good argument.
Right.
Now, where all of this, now all of this is sort of a warning and a precursor to dealing with this sigil of truth, which, as I said, is the foundational or presented to us, the way it's been presented to us by scholars and by the original people who presented it to us, John Dee and Edward Kelly, who it was allegedly presented to them by angels. This is it's not easy to understand, and there's a lot of warnings that could be stated to come with it. Now, all of this work by Brian Geisen and William Burroughs caught the attention of a man named Joseph Matheny, who I had occasion to have a lot of collaboration with. Now, he's about 10 years younger than I am, more or less. And as he grew up, he studied the work of Phil Dick, who mentioned this magic word in his book, Valis. And he studied Geisen. And he was also studying with a group called the Golden Dawn. Now, the Golden Dawn uses this sigil of truth as a backbone of its work, the Sigil de Ammit. And it was out of the Sigil de Ammit that the Enochian language was given to John Dee and Edward Kelly by the angels. Now, these angels identified themselves as the same angels who worked with King Solomon. Now, so here we are going back to the core subject. We're going back to the core subject. And whether it's true or not, they had enough either prowess to identify themselves with something on the history of time. So this represented a lot of power. But in any case, as Joe Matheny was learning about all this, he began, and being a member of the Golden Dawn at one point, he began to study the cut-up method, and he began to integrate it with computers. And this was the early days of computing. Very early days. Talking 1970s and early 80s. Now, he was basically what he did is he would create a computer program that would take a bunch of words and scramble them up. But he also connected it to the internet. He was working for a company at that time in San Francisco where he was able to tap into the internet. And this is a time when not everybody had the internet. So he was able to basically create this scrambling of information. And it was very, very interesting because he began to have experiences with it. To make a very involved story short, which is it's discussed in the book, what he did, he began to have experiences, and these experiences led him to something called the Incunabula Catalog. And it was handed to him one day when he was at a, I think it was at a party, and it was a collection of rare manuscripts, which is what an incunabula means. Incunabula is a word which means birthing cradle, or it also stood for a collection of rare manuscripts.
Okay.
And this was a, now this is now in a book form that I published called Ong's Hat, The Beginning. And this book catalog had all sorts of fringe stuff that was basically based on what Joe called crackpot Xerox literature, which had stuff on alternate dimensions, which was a book by physicist Nick Herbert, and a collection of stuff that was really on the cutting edge of physics. And he happened to notice all this catalog. He had components of it. He had the whole thing on his bookshelf, which was very odd. And so what happened is, when he saw this, it also had the Ong's Hat travel brochure, which was actually a guide to the dimensions, and it was really sort of a put-together idea. And it basically discussed a cult which was working out of Ong's Hat, New Jersey, in a place that was known as the old, in a building called the Ong's Hat Rod and Gun Club, which is where all the scientists from Princeton used to go. And they used to go there to relax, to fish and to hunt. And this included the people from the Institute for Advanced Study, which hatched the Philadelphia experiment. And this was a whole different avenue of approaching the anomalies of space-time physics than, say, Montauk. And when I met Joe and we used to discuss this, I said that Montauk represented the right wing of time travel or, you know, space-time projects, because it had Nazis, and it was very much like the worst aspects of the right wing. Whereas Ong's Hat was much more the left wing. It had dope. It had hippies. It had sexual tantra. It had Sufi mystics. And its roots were said by legend to be tied to the Moorish Science Temple. And this was something that, at that time, I thought was a legend. I didn't know that there were actual Moorish science temples that existed. And this is when you said earlier, well, what, I actually met people from the Moorish Science Temple. I've lectured at the Moorish Science Temple in Washington, D.C. So I met a bunch of Moors, and boy, did they enrich my life.
Yeah.
And they were and are some of my favorite people. Very knowledgeable, and so this is one of the, because I give quite a bit of tribute to the Moors in this book, the Synchronicity and the Seventh Seal. Although at that time I didn't even know they existed, I was just writing about the legacy of these people, and sure enough, I made some wonderful friends that I treasure to this day.
That's great.
Yes, and they also, that whole interaction with the Moors paved my way in part. It was, on the one hand, it was paved by my Qigong teacher. It was paved by Artie Crippen, the Montauk medicine man, but it was also Sharia Jones Bay, who told me about, the first one that mentioned that the classes, oh, you can come to the classes on Saturday and Sunday. I said, oh, there are classes. Now, I said, you know, how did you get the name Bay? Oh, that's my name. I was, you know, she grew up in the Moorish Science Temple. And, wow, she wasn't going to it now, but she grew up. So it was like an actual Moor who guided me to my Qigong class. It was a Montauk Indian on the one hand and a Moor on the other hand.
Wow.
So that was And I recognize it by writing all about this stuff, which, as I say, some of the words and stuff, they sound ominous in all this, but one is following a path of truth. Now, keep in mind, this is a sigil of truth is what it means, the sigil of truth. Now, I'm following a path of truth. I am not bowing down or subservient to this sigil of truth, but it's a metaphor that I've encountered upon my adventures, which have led me to certainly an inner truth. So I describe this as a metaphor for the construct of existence because that's how it is presents itself in the pathway of how it appears. But back to Joseph Matheny, who was learning how to program computers so that he could take advantage of this cut-up method and enhance it. And the whole idea of the programs that he was creating were to use this cut-up method and to take out the ego filter. He was mixing this internet with magazine articles, television and radio phrases, newspaper copy, anything you might encounter on the street, and removing the normal ego filter from the narrative voice and tapping into a higher plane by allowing the spirit or the spirit world to speak, not unlike mediumship.
Wait, how was he doing that exactly?
Well, by doing this cut-up method, the same thing that Burroughs was doing, but he was amplifying it. Burroughs was talking to entities, and you'll see him in the movie Naked Lunch. He's writing, and you'll see an octopus-like alien hanging onto his typewriter that's talking to him. Now, Burroughs might have been helped along with some narcotics or whatnot, but nevertheless, and there is a rare book that I have in copy form, called The Process by Brian Gysin. Again, it's G-Y-S-I-N, who incorporated the cut-up methodology into his writing. So, as I say, Joe was already interested in James Joyce and the Dada movement and surrealism, and he was amping it up by putting into the, connecting it to the internet. And then what resulted was this encounter with this secret project called Ong's Hat. And it was completely synchronistic. And you're re-scrambling ideas. Now, if you take everything that exists in the universe and you assign a word to it, which isn't really correct, but it represents a word. It's actually a living, everything's a living word. And then you re-scramble all those words, well, you're going to get a different interpretation of reality. If you re-scramble everything that's behind those words, now you're getting into re-scrambling existence.
Yeah, but who's doing all that for whose benefit?
Well, here's where you have to wonder is who's already done what for what benefit. That's where you get to the question. So when the system fails, as it did during World War I, the artists who are the creators start rebelling and they start creating their own reality because World War I wasn't too good.
Right.
We don't remember what post-World War I was like, but it was horrible if you read about it. Yeah. They don't emphasize that so much. So, but Joe was looking at this Incunabula catalog as what he termed a meta book. Now, this is not a book in a regular sense. He said there's a history of meta books that might include the Emerald Tablets of Thoth or the Book of Enoch. They're mentioned in history, but they don't quite appear in a tangential form. Sometimes you get a watered down version. But these exist as pure information on a metaplane that can be accessed and channeled. So when we talk about the chambers beneath the Sphinx in Romania, mm-hmm. we have a meta database. All right? We have a metabase of data. It's not necessarily something you can go in and look at and ask either stupid questions or intelligent questions.
Right.
Crowley's Book of the Law is sort of like this. It's an enigmatic, you can't pin it down. You could even say the Bible is to some extent a meta book, because the Bible, although it appears in print, represents a lot of concepts which have life. You see the life because people believe in it. So it's breathing life into people. Whether you like the life it's breathing into them or not, it's a very powerful book.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like that was pasted together with the cutout method.
Well, somebody had to pick and choose what went in it.
Right.
That's for darn sure. And it's been interpreted and translated into different ways. Now, as Joe evolved, he was eventually connected up to the World Wide Web as it became the World Wide Web, not the early bulletin board system or the early DARPANET, which was only for the big companies, and even then it was pretty stilted compared to what it is today.
Mm-hmm.
And he refers to hyper thinking. Now we have a hyperlink in the web. Links that refer to other links.
Right.
But he was actually postulating that hyper thinking could pull thoughts out of the ether, literally out of spirit, out of nowhere. And this is not unprecedented in regular experience, where things kind of come out of the ether, or where you have all these, the 100th monkey effect, where all the monkeys on one island learn something, and then a monkey on another island learns it, and there's no logical explanation except that it came through. Now, as he developed, he found some AI or artificial intelligence software that had a open source code that was developed at MIT. And he was, by that time, he'd evolved as a programmer to where he could program that into the meta machine. So it began to have a personality of its own. And it could make conclusions, it could infer things, and his own relationship with it became rather both interesting and disturbing. And that's because the so-called author of this catalog, of the Ong's Hat travel brochure, or the actual incunabula catalog, the proprietor was Emery Cranston, which is really a pseudonym. But Emery Cranston is a character who wore a fez, and he was very strange and mysterious. And Joe talked to somebody on the phone who he did not think it was the real Emery Cranston. He thought it was Peter Lamborn Wilson, who was the author of the Ong's Hat travel brochure. But whatever the situation was, because he traveled to New Jersey all the way to Ong's Hat to investigate this, well, lo and behold, he ran into the real-life Emery Cranston one day on the Berkeley campus when he was living in San Francisco. And he began to run into Emery in the strangest circumstances, Emery Cranston, to the point where he would ask the meta machine a question, and Emery would come up in an inopportune time with an answer. He'd have the answer, like he knew what Joe was writing into the machine. And this was very strange, because the machine at that time, now Joe was he was like the project manager for Adobe Acrobat, so he was involved in a very high level at Adobe Systems, and at that time he had a computer that was in the most secure area of Adobe software, where he'd have to go downstairs through an elevator with all these codes, and he said it was like the TV show Get Smart, where you have to have a magnetic card to get in the building, and then he'd have to get in the elevator and then into a hallway, and finally he'd get into the deepest security. And if you didn't have the right card and whatnot, you couldn't get in. So, in other words, he would do his metamachine work when nobody was around. There was hardly anybody else in that room, like maybe one or two people at most. And they so basically, no, there's no way Emery could have accessed that, what he was putting into the metamachine.
Right.
So Emery was like, he was, this was a, you talk about a hyperlink. This was strange business.
Yeah.
And a lot of this culminated around the time I met Joe, and he had gone out to Montauk.
You met who?
Joe Matheny.
Oh, okay.
I met him on the phone, and I couldn't, he came to New York to go visit Montauk because he'd heard about Montauk, and I could not go with, I didn't talk to him till he got back. But it was like right after he got back, he must have been recovering from this experience when I first called him. Now that I think about it sequentially, it's very interesting because he went to Montauk. I was told I could meet with him, but I didn't even know who he was. Exactly. I didn't know all of his history. I knew he was involved with a website for Ong's Hat because I'd already been exposed to Ong's Hat from a different quarter. But when Joe, what had happened is he came back from Montauk and he's walking down Spofford Alley in Chinatown in San Francisco. And Spofford Alley is a very narrow street. It's cobblestone. Mm-hmm. And it's one strange place. And he liked to go to Chinatown because you could eat and have this food that is not like you're going to eat at the Imperial Palace in your local Chinese restaurant. No, this stuff is real authentic Chinese.
Yeah, I've been there.
Yeah, and he said it was like being in a foreign country. He could just leave and go in a foreign country. So anyway, he's walking, and he ends up walking down Spofford Alley of all places. Now, Spofford Alley has this 36 Spofford Alley, big red building. Now, all these buildings are sandwiched in between each other. It's a big red building, and it says Chinese American Freemasonic Hall. Okay? And sitting underneath the doorway is Emery Cranston. What the hell is this guy doing here?
Yeah.
Now, the significance of that building, and I was just there in October, cannot be underestimated. But Emery made some comments to Joe. How was your trip to Montauk? And he said a few other personal details to Joe, which pissed Joe off to no end. Like, you know, he felt like he was being intruded upon.
Yeah.
Like at which point he began to strangle Emery. Like, you know, who the hell are you? You know, like, he did not appreciate this.
Yeah.
It was a very visceral response. And he saw Emery's eyes go limp and just kind of roll back. And he recognized those as the look of somebody who's just about to pull a knife out and stab you in the back.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if Emery had a knife on him or if he was predisposed that way, but Joe let him go and just kind of, you know, what the hell are you doing, and left. And as has happened frequently with Joe, he wants to get away from all this stuff. It's too much. So, but I'm only realizing that I had to have called him a very short time, relatively short time after that happened, at which point he said that he wanted to spend the next year working with me because he had a synchronicity generator. And that's what this metamachine was a synchronicity generator. Hmm. He called this cut-up method, this grand cut-up method, the metamachine. And it was generating synchronicity. And he said it got to the point sometimes where it would become so amplified that one could get extremely paranoid. Finally, he shut it off because it was too much. Was generating too much hyperthinking. Now, why this becomes significant Well, it's already a significant and interesting story. And I suppose I should say, when I was out in San Francisco in October, I went to that building. And I drove by. I was in the passenger seat with my friend was driving. And I said to the lady, I said, I'd like to get in there. There was a key on it. How can I get a tour of that? She says, oh, you have to go to the FBI. Because she said it had been locked up. Now, there had been a bust there. The day after I mentioned it on the radio with Douglas Dietrich, I said, do you know this building in Spofford Alley, this tong? It's called a Qigong Tong or Qigong Tong. And there was a big bust there that happened the next day because the leader of it, and was the most prestigious lead job you could have in Chinatown, as far as the who runs Chinatown, was Shrimp Boy Choi. And he was busted on all sorts of charges, along with a Leland Yee, a California state senator. And they were accused of being involved in guns and drugs and all sorts of nefarious things. And so I also learned when I was in San Francisco that this was where the president of China, Sun Yat-sen, used to have his headquarters when he was out of China. So this was the main hub of China. So it was a very powerful place.
Right.
And there are quantum implications there, which we won't go into. However, that's something that has developed since my initial understanding and interest in this particular place in Chinatown. But in any case, Joe had also put the Enochian language, so to speak, into the meta machine. So you had this meta machine that was operating with the Enochian calls and whatnot.
Wow.
And stuff was inside of it. Now, any time, and this stuff is written about in the book The Seventh Seal, mm-hmm. but any time he would bring this up to people and mention what he was actually doing, people would have very strange reactions. Those in the academic corner would become very haughty and arrogant and accuse him of hubris, which is, you know, he's arrogant, he's saying too much about this. No, this can't be. You know, how dare you say that you can do such a thing?
Yeah.
In other words, they were small thinkers. They were small men. They were small people. And what did Joe had done? It could not be appreciated. The other people would have weird reactions to it. In other words, they'd want to own or possess it. And they'd become covetous of it. And because it represents power.
Right.
And this is a madness that often people in the magical arts or the occult get attracted to power.
Yeah. So who does control it now?
I don't think it's really something you can control.
Oh.
He shut the meta machine down. He shut it down and disassembled it. And that, because, as they say, it was unwieldy for him.
Yeah.
Now, people can think that this is all bullshit or whatnot. I couldn't make stuff up that was this good.
Yeah.
Now, this caught the attention of academia, the University of California at Santa Cruz, where a resident professor by the name of Ralph Abraham had been studying John Dee himself, but from a mathematical reference frame, because John Dee had basically translated Euclid into English. And he wrote a whole prologue to the introduction. So he put a lot of works in Latin and Greek into the English language. And he is the academic opposite. He's the academic opposite of all scholarly work, practically, in the Western world. And when I say opposite, that's when you are referring to, you know, Ibid, you refer to the earlier reference in a scholarly work. You cite the reference, and then you cite Ibid, which means the reference just before. And then opposite is to the one, you don't say Ibid again, you say opposite, which means, I don't know exactly what it means, but it refers to the Latin, it refers to the one before. Okay. Going to the earlier reference.
Thank you for listening to the Peter Moon Podcast. To purchase Peter's books, visit skybooksusa.com. Also visit Peter's blog at digitalmontauk.com. And to hear more music by Noosa, visit noosasounds.com. Welcome to the Peter Moon Podcast, brought to you by Sky Books and the music of Noosa.
Opposite, which actually means in the work cited, for opere citato. And that all, or virtually all, Western academic references will go back to John Dee translations. So in this way, he is a foundational component of all Western academia. Now, the association doesn't stop there, because he's also foundational major influence in the English language. And because he is translating these books into the English vernacular, and he's speaking it into the Vulgate, or the common tongue of the common person, whereas the scholarly language was Latin and Greek, he was giving it to the common man. Now, John Dee had learned of this sigil from his dialoguing with the angels. And
when did he do this?
This is in the 1500s, the late 1500s.
Okay. It's funny, when I googled sigil de Amath, I pulled up John Dee's chart.
His birth chart?
His sigil.
Well, that's what you would expect to find. Now, that sigil, the way he, there's various stories about John Dee, but the way he came upon all of this was when he, well, first you have to understand the context of John Dee. He had the biggest library in all of England and practically the world. The Vatican would have had a bigger library.
Wow.
And he was a Renaissance man. He understood everything. He created the meridian system. He created celestial navigation. And this enabled the British Empire to basically conquer the seas. So his knowledge was... He ran the intelligence network for Queen Elizabeth. He was the coordinator of the information. The information that was gathered by the various spies would come to him, and he would interpret it and coordinate it. So he was a very, very important person.
A very smart man.
Very smart. And he grew up in the court. His father was a important person in the court of, I believe it was Henry VIII, and then the successors between him and his daughter Elizabeth. But in any case, John Dee, and he's got a colorful history, to say the least, but basically he learned everything he could learn in an academic sense, and he wanted to take the next step beyond. Mm-hmm. And then one day, you know, so he opened up to what's beyond, because I have learned everything I can learn by normal means. What else can I learn? He wanted more.
Right.
So basically,
like we all do.
Yes, so he went into the spirit realm, but one of his early encounters there, when he was given basically a crystal ball called the Shoe Stone, which was a smoky quartz. And he was given this and directed to use it. Now, he really would have people look in the crystal, but he couldn't really get anybody to react to it till he met somebody named Edward Talbot Kelly. And this became his partner, and Kelly was a scoundrel and a con man by reputation, and he had, you know, the upper part of his ears cut off because of his scandalous behavior for stealing things and whatnot. But he also had a gift of spirit, and it was, they went through a series of, I guess what you'd call, dialogues with these angels. And a lot of magic occurred them or around them. One of them was a manifestation of a golden ring when the Archangel Michael pulled out a sword to Dee and manifested a ring of gold. And Michael tells him that this is the ring by which all of Solomon's miracles were revealed and of which all of philosophy dreams. And basically he was giving him the key to what Solomon could do. This was the promise. Now, Kelly was the seer. Dee was the guy who was the chronicler. And Michael shows him the sword again. And the word Amet, or Ameth, appears, which means truth. And he's told that this is the name of a seal he will be given, and he's told that without this thou shalt do nothing.
Isn't there a gem, the amethyst? Or
this was amethyst, the truth.
Yeah.
Okay. Ameth, it means truth, the sigil of truth. And he says, he was then given detailed instructions on how to compose the sigil, which is the sigil we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. No, I understand that. I'm looking at it.
Yeah, it's a geometric layout of glyphs and with heptagons or sevens.
What language is that written in? Is it Latin?
No.
Okay.
The language of the sigil, well, it uses English letters and there's some Hebrew in there, but it's basically it's a seal of truth, but it comes in a different language.
Right.
And it's an Enochian language. It's called Enochian.
Okay.
Now, in the Bible, Enoch was the seventh son of Adam. Okay?
Okay.
And, you know, you hear this, they'd refer to it in cowboy movies often, the seventh son of the seventh son. But Enoch was the seventh son. He's also been identified in occult traditions as Hermes or Mercury.
Mm-hmm.
But scholars would be baffled by the Enochian language because it actually has its own grammar and syntax. And it's given at the same time as English becomes English. coined after the Angles or the Angels. See, the Angles were the people of Britain. They're known as Angles, the Anglo-Saxons.
Yes.
Well, this is tied to angel, angle, angel. Now, this all becomes very important when I was talking about this mathematician, scientist, Ralph Abraham at the University of Santa Cruz, who had been studying John Dee and was noticing that, you know, John Dee was basically blackballed from history. And he was interested because he was noticing the same thing that John Dee noticed, was that geometry has intention tied to it. Hmm. Now, you can get an example of that if you look at an arrow, which is a geometry. Well, you see an arrow has an intention behind it.
Right.
We know an octagon is a stop sign. That has an intention to it. You can see this around the world. Yeah. There are...
A pyramid.
Yeah, yes. And that's the pyramid is creation. Hmm. But there are all sorts of implications that come with geometry. And anyway, he was noticing that, and that's a very important point. But what basically what happened is at that same time the excuse me, the OTO, Ordo Templi Orientis, had a lot of active groups out in the Bay Area. And one of the members went back and realized that the way they were doing it, the Enochian calls, were wrong. And that the whole foundation of the Golden Dawn and what they were doing was wrong. They weren't doing the original John Dee work. So he formed, and you can read about this on the internet, the Black Lodge of Santa Cruz by Satyr, S-A-T-Y-R, who talks about all their experiences in what went down with this whole endeavor to study Enochian and do the correct rituals. Well, this group connected up with Ralph Abraham, who had a genuine interest in John Dee and the Enochian language or phenomena, and they actually used to go to the University of Santa Cruz, and they were doing Enochian rituals to demonstrate the scientific veracity of it, just in terms of getting a result. And this is discussed briefly in the book, but this turned into a bit of a funny situation when some people came in on it earlier and saw all this stuff going on. What the hell's going on? So it kind of short-circuited that whole thing, that whole operation that was being done. But it was so, I guess, precise in what it... And this was the John Dee version of Enochian. But all of this, even that being said, is still a very much a double-edged sword. Just because it caught the attention of a very brilliant academic person doesn't mean that the whole operation is without pitfalls. But this is the kind of phenomena that was cycling through society and in certain pockets of society that most people are obviously completely oblivious of, where this sigil is important is its degree of influence or degree. So it basically sits there as the resident template for what controls existence. So here you had Joe Matheny through his meta machine poking it. And you might even say threatening, if that's the right word, to descramble it.
Wow.
I mean, I don't know that he was threatening to descramble it, but he was, he had already studied the Golden Dawn, and then he learned that what they were doing in the Golden Dawn was not correct, because sometimes the results were pretty negative with what they were playing with the Enochian language, which was said to have come from John Dee, but it was altered John Dee. So here they were doing the original thing, and they'd certainly caught some interesting attention. But there was fallout for the people involved in the Black Lodge of Santa Cruz, which I have to say I don't think was as black as a lot of some of the other lodges out there. I don't know why he called it the Black Lodge, but certainly they were playing with some very formidable energy. So in any case, this is a metaphor for what regulates, controls our domain. Now,
between the angels and reality, or between someone else's reality and our reality?
Between our reality and the deity. And when I say our reality, I'm talking about the earth plane reality. And when I say deity, I'm referring to that which is the creator,
okay,
or the creative principle. Now, the angels generally, the word means messenger. So
right,
it's the intermediary. What is the interlocutor? So therefore, we could define the sigil de Amoth, or the sigil of truth, as the interlocutor between our reality and the Godhead. So and angels, by their very nature, are servants of a higher order.
Right.
And so when you engage in magic, whether it be corny magic, traditional magic, super secret magic, you are basically picking and choosing words. But you do this every day of your life. You're picking and choosing what words you're going to use.
Sure.
And one of the foundational elements of power, if you go deep into the etymology of power and associations, you'll see that has to do with choice. You can choose. You have the power to be a plumber. You have the power to be a doctor. You have the power to go to school. You have the power to fight back. And it's choosing all of these different things. So you can choose. It is the subject of empowerment. So this is where it becomes important to an individual. Now,
you reminded me of a great quote that, I'm sorry, I can't remember the author's name, but he said basically the only time a person truly has freedom is in that moment between where he's instigated and the moment he reacts. The moment in between there, he has true freedom to decide how he's going to react.
That's good. Good statement, yes.
I always like that.
Yes, and reaction will weaken you.
Yes.
And we see this in the martial arts when you react as opposed to respond. You react, and it can compromise your whole situation, whatever you're doing. So now, all of this, and I want to give an example, because as I say, so much of what came up here, this is the paradigm we're living under currently, is this idea that there's this sigil out there that represents the interface between us and the deity. Now, Joe had the idea of turning this into a holographic representation. Now, that the sigil, if you read the sigil, it's two-dimensional. If you go on the net and look up Jonathan Gee, you'll see that he's got some nice, he gives a color code for the sigil, how it should be put in color.
Yes, and he does some, see that one too.
Yeah, very good. But, and there's been magicians that have studied this very seriously, devoted a lot of time to it.
Right.
The only thing that can be said is that none of them have completely figured it out.
Yeah.
Now,
I was going to ask, is there an English translation for it somewhere?
Well,
I'm assuming there is.
No, you have to learn the Enochian, because the Enochian is the sim, is the, but there is a more fundamental way to approach it than the Enochian language, and that's the pure geometry itself. The pure geometry itself. Now, you have to understand that the Hebrew language and the Enochian language are all based upon responses to ideas. And these ideas have a root in geometry, in some form of geometric symbol or whatnot, vectors or whatnot. So it's, but as I say, I've never tried to learn Enochian. And this comes, I was going to go off in the direction of the holography, because Joe was working with somebody or knew somebody in Santa Cruz who was going to set up a whole paradigm for making a hologram of the human brain. And it made him think, well, God, what if I make a hologram of the sigil, a three-dimensional representation?
Yeah.
Now, when John Dee channeled in the angels with Edward Kelly, they put big tablets. They made about at least five tablets of wax tablets, and I don't think they were color-coded like they could have or should have been, but they put one under each leg of the table, and then they put one in the center of the table, and then they put the crystal ball in the center. So when you look through the crystal ball, you could see through the letters that were on the sigil, you could begin to read the angelic names, and you could see things through the crystal ball. It helped you see what was actually there. Although I don't think it was anywhere near as clear as you'll find on Jonathan Gee's website or YouTube's.
Yeah.
And even then, he's only made it so clear. Now, so the holographic theme is very important as it ties into the later work in Romania. But to go back to the problem with all of this. Now, as I mentioned, when I was editing this book and I came to the sigil, well, you know, David Anderson emails me. He says, I'll do a podcast anytime you want. Okay, great. Now, people who study Enochian believe very strongly that this language is designed to bring about the apocalypse, and not incorrectly necessarily, because if the sigil, which is what the Enochian language sort of is rooted to or ties to, and the sigil is the metaphor for what's holding everything in place, well then, studying that language and making it fluid, making this geometric symbol a dynamic movement of what unfolding, enfolding, imploding, exploding. In actual fact, as we study it, it's a two-dimensional symbol. As we project it into a hologram, it becomes a three-dimensional symbol with four-dimensional capabilities. But that already is gyrating in our universe now. When we study it, we look at it as two-dimensional. It's already a living, breathing, vibrating word. It's a word. And this is what we get back to, the magic word, and we get back to Brian Geisen saying, rub out the word, rearrange it, reconfigure it. Just like when you have a team in sports that's not working, you reconfigure the team.
Right.
You get somebody who can make up the component parts. So this is an interesting idea. Now, there's another man who's lectured on the internet, and I just came across him by accident in terms of I was looking at something on the YouTube, and his name is Vincent Bridges, and he gives some very informative lectures about the history of John Dee and Edward Kelly. He also touches on the Enochian language, and he claims to be one of 12 people who actually understand it. I cannot vouch for anything he says.
Right.
Except that he gives a damn interesting talks. Now, Vincent Bridges first came up on my radar as this book was being formulated, as this book was being written. And he came to me through Joseph Matheny, the name of him. I didn't know who the hell he was. And I really didn't care too much because I was involved with unwinding this book. I had no idea Vincent Bridges had anything to do with the study of John Dee or the Enochian language. And Joe had some form of communication with him, and then there was some sort of falling out that I never, that was associated with a lady who ran a website called Cassiopeia. And Cassiopeia, her name was Laura Knight. Jacek Knight or Knight Jacek, Laura Jacek Knight, I believe her name was, with a K. And she had captured a lot of people's attention with a lot. She was very voluminous in what she posted and had a very active mind, a lot of mental. She was a mental gymnast. She could move her mind around a lot. But her posts were so long that I could never get interested. I know a lot of people were raving about her, and what I had learned from people who had studied her and never really studied her myself is that she would basically take somebody under her wing, promote them, and then say they were a COINTELPRO. And I believe the same thing happened with Vincent Bridges, where she'd take him under her wing and promote him and then kind of turn on him. All right?
Yeah.
Now, I really, this is just the rap she has. I don't really have no experience with her, nor desire for an experience in this regard. Obviously not. But
right.
Joe was monitoring a lot of things on the internet, and he had also witnessed this. And it was, and then, but so whatever the case is, that's how I became acquainted with the name Vincent Bridges. And as you said, there was some sort of falling out. He sort of, him and Joe didn't, I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened. But now I appear, here it is years later, and I found out this guy is a student of Enochian and a student of John Dee, and he's given some fascinating lectures. And he kind of talks about his strange experiences and how he got involved. I don't think he even quite knows how he acquired all this knowledge. But I noticed as I listened to him talk, as I watched him talk on the YouTube, he's having a strange problem. I can see it in his physicality. He's slowly, very slowly, beginning to look like Igor from the Frankenstein movies. And I'm not joking here.
Yeah.
It's slow. It's sort of like if you see Lon Chaney in The Wolfman and he slowly transforms.
Right.
He's in the initial stage where Lon Chaney's just beginning to grow some growth and, you know, the little widow's peak, and he's starting to change a little bit. Well, that's, I could see this in Vincent Bridges when I'm watching him talk. I'm saying, oh my God, he's getting the Igor complex. Now, it's funny. When I mentioned this to a friend of mine who's very, very knowledgeable, and I wouldn't have thought she was so knowledgeable about Enochian, when she says, stop, don't talk to me about it. I know this stuff. I said, I have to stay away from it. I had a teacher who was involved in it. And I said, well, you know, I just got to say something. That this guy was starting to look like Igor. She says, exactly. Her teacher started to look like Igor, too. And now this is a woman.
Right.
Maybe she was a beautiful woman. I don't know.
Yeah.
But whatever, whether she was beautiful or not, she started to look like Igor.
So
and,
if you find
inner beauty in Igor, that's great. But what I'm saying is he was studying something that was overtaking him. What were you going to say?
I was going to say, so if you study Enochian, you turn into Igor, and if you study, who's the devil guy? I'm sorry, his name's slipping me. Jimmy Page lived in this house.
Oh, Aleister Crowley.
Yeah, if you study Aleister Crowley.
Good analogy.
Yeah.
Yes, if you study Aleister Crowley, you might take on the aspects of Aleister Crowley and the reflection of Aleister Crowley as. But again, it wasn't Igor that channeled Enochian. Igor is a character from the movies, played
right.
by Bela Lugosi. So why he started to, you know, but he started to look like the. You know, the diminutive minion of a force that wasn't so becoming to anybody.
It was sucking the life out of them.
Thank you for listening to the Peter Moon Podcast. To purchase Peter's books, visit skybooksusa.com. Also visit Peter's blog at digitalmontauk.com.
And to hear more music by Noosa, visit noosasounds.com.
On one level, yes. Now, when we go into the history of Vincent Bridges, as discussed by himself, it's both intriguing and noteworthy, if not alarming. And by his own words, he claims to have been an associate of André Puharich. And André Puharich was, as I've discussed him earlier, as Preston identified him as the head of the CIA Aquarius Group. By Puharich's own statements, he was in the Army Medical Corps, and he was doing in PSYOPs for the Army. This is back in World War II. So, and he was a naysayer of the Montauk Project in the beginning, and he was considered a counterproductive creature on the scene, only because of all the different things I heard. Certainly, and he, as they say, he was the one who sort of took Uri Geller under his wing. But Puharich and had learned from Aldous Huxley, an agent of the Tavistock Institute in London. So anyway, here is Vincent Bridges having Puharich as a colleague. And I said, this is like, and I will say one thing about Vincent Bridges. He kept very bad company. He's like, if you listen to him talk, he's very engaging. Seems like a very nice man. But the one thing I can say is that he kept bad company. And to the day he died. And that's no aspersion to his wife, because I don't know her. There's no comment on his wife, because I have no comment on her, because I don't know her. But anyway, he also mentions that he went and worked for Christopher Hyatt, also known as Dr. Alan Miller, Dr. Christopher Hyatt, who is a famous occult author. And Hyatt's an interesting character because he was one of Joe Matheny's mentors in the Golden Dawn, and a friend of Joe Matheny's. Puharish and Hyatt are both passed away. Now, Hyatt was a heavy drinker. He loved motorcycles. And as they say, I owe him thanks for paving my way to meet Marjorie Cameron, because I had met him at the book fair in Anaheim in 1992. And I went up to him. He looked like a biker. He looked like somebody that most people wouldn't want to approach. And he was there in a book fair, you know, dressed in, you know, like he was a character in a Hell's Angels novel or something. But he was very nice. He says, "Oh, go to so and so and see so and so," and bop 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 bop. He paved the way for me. But I also learned about Hyatt from Joe, that Hyatt, when Israel Regardi had the Golden Dawn materials and the materials of some of which were Ordo Templi Orientis materials, and this was in Arizona, Hyatt had to protect Regardi, because there were people literally coming after Regardi that were going to, I mean, it was violent what people would do to get at those materials, the Crowley materials. There was the same thing happened with the L. Ron Hubbard materials before the internet, all this stuff that people laugh about.
Yeah.
Those things were highly sought after. I don't know that there were guns involved ever, but people paid big money to get at that so-called secret information,
right,
about Xenu and all this stuff. There was big money paid for that stuff, and it was a black market. Well, the black market, this was the forces that were going after Israel Regardi. And I've also written about some of that situation in the book as well. But Hyatt was his guardian protector. And they were too unlikely. They didn't fit together. Because here is Israel Regardi, who's basically an effeminate gay person, and Hyatt, and who's like a biker, who'd eat somebody like that for breakfast if he wanted to. But he protected him to the point where Joe told me one time somebody came to go visit him. He knocked on his door, and Hyatt answers the door with a gun. "What the hell are you doing?" And he says, "Well, I didn't." He said, "Next time you call," because he had been put through the ringers. Now, who were these people coming after Israel Regardi? More importantly than Regardi, they wanted the Enochian information, the OTO information, the Crowley information. Now, this is at a time when there wasn't stuff on the internet. It was very highly prized. I think it was agents of the intelligence agencies, of the government. That's what I think.
Yeah, it makes sense.
That were being driven by demonic forces that might have been emanating out of the metaphorical sigil, so to speak, because those energies run both hot and cold. Now, this is Vincent Bridges claims to be working with Hyatt and running drugs for him. Now, I don't know that that's true, but he claims that he went into Mexico and did a drug mission for Hyatt. Now, being that Hyatt was an alcoholic, and you can see him on YouTube slurring his words and whatnot, it wouldn't surprise me. I wouldn't put it beyond him,
yeah.
But I don't really know. But here is Vincent Bridges saying, he ran drugs for Christopher Hyatt as part of, I guess, proving himself, because he portrayed himself as somebody who wouldn't do that. And he doesn't come off as somebody who would do that. Those are the best people to do it. But in any case, he makes this claim that he worked for Hyatt. Then he makes an additional claim that he met with Hyatt on a houseboat in Sausalito, which is right north of San Francisco, right north of the Golden Gate Bridge, beautiful little city.
Yep.
And he was on a houseboat with Hyatt and Michael Aquino. Now, Michael Aquino is the man who founded the Temple of Set. He was a colonel, known as Colonel Michael Aquino. I think he was promoted beyond colonel. And he wrote the Satanic Bible. He was the chaplain. He wrote the chaplain's handbook, Satanic Chaplain's Handbook for the United States Army.
At the Presidio, right?
He worked at the Presidio. Yeah. And so, in any case, Aquino denied this. And Hyatt's not around. I don't know that Hyatt ever denied it or confirmed it, but he's not around anymore. Aquino still is around, and he denies that he had anything to do with that he was never on a houseboat in Sausalito and that he didn't know Vincent Bridges. He also denies any involvement with Douglas Dietrich, which is hard to fathom. But in any case, as I say, Vincent Bridges kept bad company. And if these people are falsely accused, Vincent Bridges at least portrayed them as people where he was keeping bad company. But these are not all the bad company either. So in any case, he gives some very cogent and fascinating talks about John Dee and Edward Kelly. And he even explains, quite interestingly, how that when John Dee was doing all this angelic work, he was approached by a man, last name Lasky, who told him, hey, wait, there's a sigil, a real-life sigil over in Prague, in Czech, which is Bohemia. Then, now it's Czechoslovakia, or no, actually, Czech Republic. And so Dee and Kelly went over to Prague, and this is where they did all their channeling, was in Prague. All the angelic language was in Bohemia, of which Prague was the capital. And because there was a real life sigil, and further that the sigil itself, well, it was sort of stamped into the environment. So the representation, I'm talking about a metaphor, that this metaphor construct had manifested in the vicinity of Prague. And in addition to that, he states that the whole area of Prague had what was called prima matria, which is the prime matter for turning base metals into gold. And Kelly had a reputation for creating gold. And this is a whole drama we're not going to go into here about creating gold. The alchemist, Kelly was historically not only a con man, but a legitimate alchemist who could literally make gold. And this has historical veracity. We don't always know if history is true, but there is a history of them. And of him also.
I'd like to know how to do that.
Well, it might be more trouble than it's worth.
Yeah.
Because the real gold is inside of you. But we're really talking about it because, well, anybody who studies this stuff is walking off the gangplank pretty much. And at the end, and it's not too long before he passed away, Vincent Bridges passed away just last year. I'm studying this guy. Listen, I said, whatever happened to this guy? Well, he passed away last July. He's not even been dead a year yet. But then in his last lecture on the Enochian language, everything he says is pretty cogent. And then he totally goes off the rails, in my opinion, when he says there's only 12 people that know the Enochian language. And only half a dozen of those I wouldn't trust. And he says, but what we need to do is, you know, get people to understand and learn this, because we're walking around in these meat bodies if we want to survive these coming times. And he's making the coming times sound so drastic that we have to do something.
Yeah.
So it's like we have to get out and Enochianize ourselves And I'm thinking, like, oh, my God, this guy's off the deep end. He thinks he's got to save the planet.
Right.
And when...
There's a lot of fear-mongers out taking that stance.
But he's largely an intellect.
Right.
And then he jumps off. He jumps off. He didn't have to jump off, but he did. And then he jumped off the Earth entirely. But, I mean, I could also see, you know, the arthritis in his neck and the slow. I mean, this is like, you know, it was part of the Igor transformation. And, but, you know, when you say that this Earth can chew people up and spit them out, the universe can do this. Human beings are very arrogant to think that they're in a position where they can save the Earth. And this routinely happens with people. And maybe somebody somewhere can push a button that can make things better. But most people aren't in a position to do much other than look after their own lives. And that's the most important thing. And that's the most empowering thing to do, is to look after your own situation.
Yeah.
So, but as I say, Vincent Bridges he does not come off as a negative occultist at all if you listen to him talk. But then if you actually look a bit further, study what he says about himself, and look how he ends off on that tape, he's jumping into the pit. And this is symptomatic of what happens when people study it. Nevertheless, this leaves us with this paradigm of this sigil of creation. We could call it a sigil of creativity. It's known as the sigil of truth. And it represents a metaphor by which this cosmos is regulated. Vincent Bridges even goes into a very simple, and I felt not completely adequate, explanation of how all of these work represents this is an extension of the magic word, and it's time I told you the magic word, which you've already heard actually in my previous talks, is that all of this iterations of the metamachine and all of these interactions with Joe and all I had learned in my experience with him, which had been was at least for an entire year we interacted on a really voluminous basis, and it extended after that to a significant time as well, was the appreciation of the secret word of Freemasonry, which is basically the Hebrew letter Shin, which is the middle letter of Yod He Shin Vav He, transliterated into Yeshua or Jesus. This is where we get the word Jesus.
Right.
And the Shin is the fulcrum. It's the thing on which everything rests. And this, the five letters are represented in the pentagram, which is an extension of the four-letter tetragrammaton, which means four letters. Pentagrammaton is five letters, four into five, and four is Yod Heh Vav Heh, sometimes symbolized as fire, water, air, and earth, and then you have fire, water, spirit, air, and earth. Shin also means heart in the Chinese language, and it also represents the moon in ancient Chaldea, and Shin was the capital city of Babylon. Shin is where we get shine, meant the moon, the crescent moon, and eventually the Hebrews who had the crescent or had the boar or the pig as their totem, why they don't eat pork, because it's related to human beings, is that crescent tooth looks like the moon. So that was the Shin, which it meant in Chaldea or Babylon. It meant Shin, mean shine for the moon, but because the moon is like a crescent, tooth took on the word shin. So the Hebrews called shin tooth, but the rabbis recognized that shin meant spirit or change. So when you have the five elements, or the four elements, shin being the fifth element, yod, hey, vav, hey, with the shin could operate through fire, water, air, and earth, and could combine all of those. And that's your alchemy. You can combine the characteristics or qualities. That's a foundational point of alchemy, is to combine characters or qualities of elements. So this shin is the cornerstone of the word. But when we take the sigil, you see in the center of the sigil is a pentagram. And Vincent Bridges describes in his YouTube how the pentagon, if amalgamated with other shapes, pentahedron, it creates a template that's not only three-dimensional, but has access to the fourth dimension. This is hard to show without graphics. This is why the occultist uses the pentagram to banish spirits, because they come in from the fourth dimension. So he's representing a polygon, a cube, where things can enter and exit this dimension. So that is a nodal point of creation, a theoretical nodal point of creation, done through the instrument of the sigil. So you could say that all of this rigmarole that I've arrived at or gone through and discussed here with you today is arriving at the idea that, there's a post here. Oh, there's somebody we can talk to. Mm-hmm. Well, William Burroughs could talk to people. Joe had his own experiences with Emery Cranston and whatnot. And this is a, you know, but who or what are you talking to? Because these angels played some pretty dirty tricks on John Dee and Edward Kelly. The angel had them swap wives. And that really screwed things up for both of them. It kind of cut them off totally.
Yeah.
It did cut them off because they didn't really do it. And they were promised things and this and that. And John Dee died in poverty. So you see that this is this route to...
Can you call those angels then?
Yes, you can.
Yeah. Okay.
Because an angel is a messenger.
Oh, right.
An angel is an angle. Yeah. And an angel is double-sided.
Oh, I didn't realize the double-sided part.
Well, an excellent analogy to see the nature of an angel or a demon.
Right, that's what I was thinking.
That movie, Raiders of the Lost Ark, when they open up the ark and all those angels come out, they're angels, and then they turn into a demon.
Yeah.
They're double-sided. A demon is double-sided.
Okay.
It's a Diablo. That doesn't mean there aren't good angels. But the nature of what's being dealt with here is double-sided. And this is why, if we can accept the historical accounts of Joan of Arc, these voices guide her, and they beat the English. But who gets the last laugh? The English get the last laugh, because the voices that guided her basically left her to burn. They left her to burn.
Yeah.
They did not protect her, as far as we know historically.
Right.
So, you see, what were these voices that... You know, with all due respect to her, she was indulging in warfare and death and killing, which, you know, she got some backlash. I'm not saying that what she did is right or wrong, but anytime you start dealing with the spirit realm on a deep and powerful level, she was influencing governments. You have to account for various factors. So This is one of the challenges of dealing with. So we call, they call this the sigil of truth. Well, in the book Synchronicity and the Seventh Seal, in one of the stories that I write is, I give back the Ring of Power because it's not something that really should be worn by a human being.
Yeah.
It's too, and then when one seeks that power, one is more, you know, it's like somebody seeking to get rich. They get kind of lost and psycho in the process of, I gotta get rich. What are you getting rich for? What are you gonna do with your life once you get rich? And then you have to maintain your wealth. You have to think of tax strategies. You have to, you know, it can become, wealth can become a burden to an individual.
Right. I think I'd enjoy it. I'd like to travel and read.
Yes, but I'm talking about wealth and, you know, most people who are really hard workers and have this great strive to get rich, they want to get richer and richer. They don't necessarily have that, you know, like you know, Rupert Murdoch, he hasn't quit, has he?
No.
He could have been traveling and reading for the last 20 or 30 years.
Yeah.
Pursuing.
Greedier and greedier.
Well, whatever. It's what he does. He's an empire. He's an empire man. You know, he's not the only one.
Yeah.
So, whatever. And whatever power he has is temporary. So, this, when we come into the present, and all of these things that have been mentioned, this is sort of not only a part of the story of what is in Synchronicity and the Seventh Seal. Of course, I've extended it beyond that. This is also a follow-up lecture to that book. So if somebody is interested in this book, they might want to read the book and then come back to this lecture and listen to it again, because where we stand now, as I talk to you about this sigil, because it's came up into my consciousness again, and I say David Anderson is knocking at the door to do a podcast, and he knocks at the door at the exact same time that I'm looking at the sigil for the first time in a long time, and also rereading all of this material so it's fresher in my mind. And he represents the reassemblage, or the rubbing out of the word, so to speak, the word we've known, the assemblage, because if he indeed can change time, well, how does that parlay into the Enochian language, the Enochian angels? Who the hell knows?
Yeah.
Except that he is an agent of change. He is an agent of change. And now there's also an interesting statement that Dee makes. He tries to pin one of the angels down, Michael. He says, come when I'm ready. And Michael tersely replies by saying, we lead time. Time leadeth not us.
Hmm.
So here is, this is John Dee being told that these characters can change time. We leadeth time. We create time. We direct time. So the understanding of this sigil gives us an understanding. It's like a muscle that is not used. Once you start to lubricate the muscle and use the muscle, now all of a sudden it can lift weights, it can move screwdrivers, it can use hammers, you can use it. So we're living in a time where this sigil is coming under an influence of greater understanding. And as they say, there's a lot of magicians that have studied this language and studied this sigil, and they've tried and tried and tried. And, you know, what can you say? You can say they've done a lot of hard work, but they don't have the final answer.
Yeah.
And I'm coming at it from a completely different quarter, because if I go, you know, to quote from the book, the warning on the book. The path is littered with the skulls and bones of those who have failed to penetrate the mystery, yet adorn themselves with the insignia of their own failure. So from Vincent Bridges onward, these people try to discover the mystery. But the mystery isn't the word. Shin, which means change, and it means spirit, and it means heart. Mm-hmm. So from the very, all of this stuff is based upon geometry. When we think of the idea of this sigil being turned into a holographic projection, then we have a metaphor for a live working example of what is the interlocutor between the heaven and the earth. When we go to my more recent work in Romania, where I published the work of Radu Shinamar, and he is talking about this underground chamber which he's been into, which has all the possible permutations of DNA available in the universe, with further mysteries and a projection hall that can take you back in time, and a tunnel, three tunnels, one of which leads to beneath Egypt, where there's another time machine which will take you to time. But the controllers in that book, Mystery of Egypt, do not want you to find out too much about who they are. So you have a controlling realm. In this sense, if we can take the holographic projections or the idea of them that are projected in that book to compare this to the sigil of John Dee, the sigil of the Amit, that would be a projection that could basically manifest all of reality in all of its different possible permutations of reality that you could possibly conceive of, would theoretically could or would be housed in the components of that sigil, including all of the time possibilities. And so when you say the apocalypse is the uncovering, or the uncovering of the goddess of creation, then you have basically, you could say, all hell breaking loose, because you wouldn't just have hell breaking loose, you'd have everything breaking loose.
Yeah.
So the universe had to be constructed somehow. It had to have a blueprint. And it has a record. And this particular sigil is the most documented reference to the predicament or paradigm I've just described. And so, you know, we started a mystery, we come back to the mystery, but the very solution to the mystery is in the secret word itself, which is the spirit and the change and the heart. So it all begins in there, and it all enters. And in the warning, I mentioned the mirror of one's own reality that includes your wildest dreams and their fulfillment, but also your greatest nightmares.
Yes.
It's basically going inside of yourself, because the brain, as they say, we're using a small portion of our brain if we're a typical human being. And by a different system, Goetia, you have all of these pathways that are blocked or not open. So there are a lot of different disciplines on the earth which have been described by various traditions, but most people wouldn't have time to do a tradition or take the time to do a tradition. And if they did, they're vulnerable to foul behavior and foul play. That's just the way it is. So one has to rely on their spirit and their heart and their own personal ability to change things. As they say, what I have realized, come to realize in dealing with this sigil is basically it all, everything conforms to geometry, and because I practice Taoist Qigong and I can understand everything in terms of geometry, and when you do the exercises you're conforming to geometry, and you find your own reality, you find who you are, what you're doing, what you're thinking. So the language to me is not as important to me as the fundamental concepts behind the language, and those things only become important to me when they are encountered in my experience, whether it be walking in a circle, standing still, focusing on the built-in energy triangles of the body that are built into the energetic body, the chi body. So in the meantime, you know, one works on themselves. In the meantime, this is a paradigm that has challenged humanity, that has influenced humanity. And this cannot be overemphasized, how much this sigil and the accoutrements that come with it have influenced humanity, and the lack of understanding of it.
Well, it makes a lot of sense. It seems that a person should worry about themselves first before they start worrying about everybody else.
Right, and now we have a new paradigm in Romania and underneath the ancient sacred capital of Transylvania, Sarmizegetuza, where there are tunnels of gold. And ostensibly a point that is resonant with the creation of time, which would be creation itself. So you have a more fundamental ancient philosophy and paradigm that emanates from that area, because the alchemy and the whole idea of alchemy and having the gold is basically the gold is to permeate your consciousness. That's the real secret of alchemy, is the monoatomic gold which one they consumed in Egypt and which one can consume that will enlighten your brain so you're operating on all cylinders. That's the whole idea. But the tradition espoused by Edward Kelly and all of his associates, which were the precursor to the Rosicrucian movement, the popular Rosicrucian movement that we know as the Rosicrucians, all emanated out of the alchemy that was taking place in Prague. So Prague is of considerable interest in the history of all this. There's a lot of different angles one could go off from here, but as I say, right now, at least as far as my current work goes, the paradigm presented by the most intriguing aspect of the sigil is the holographic projection of it and the interpretation of it. And how does this parlay into the events that I've written about or published about in Romania and or the work of David Anderson? These are questions that are on the horizon. I don't expect him to have any sort of knowledge.